Or, Labour Home Secretary between 1997 and 2001 said it was preposterous and just extraordinary to leave people languishing so long in prison without a trial, charging the Conservative government with presiding over the most serious crisis in the criminal justice system that I can remember. Tory MP Robert Buckland, who served as Justice Secretary for 2 years until September of 2021, called for the cases to be examined and clearly explained, warning that people should not be on remand for years without a proper reason. A Ministry of Justice spokesperson claimed cases involving the longest waits mainly involved complex fraud or were trials with a large number of defendants that ordinarily take a long time to prosecute. Lambasting the years-long remand wait as totally and completely unacceptable, Blair-era Justice Secretary Lord Falconer said the government needs an emergency plan because we can't let these long delays continue. Lord Falconer called for the greater use of tagging for non-violent suspects and temporary Nightingale courts, while Jack Straw said ministers could do a great deal more to bring more courts into operation, including using retired and part-time judges. Rob Priest of the Howard League for Penal Reform said the overcrowding crisis is most acute in jails housing prisoners awaiting trial. He likened lengthy, Kafkaesque remand times to indefinite prison sentences, which were abolished in 2012 and criticised recently by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. Official figures show as of June, more than a fifth of those held on remand were accused of drug offences. According to most recent data, just 32% awaiting trial were remanded for allegedly violent crimes. Ian Aitchison, a former security chief at His Majesty's Prison at Wandsworth, said the under-pressure Category B London jail was just one of those struggling to cope with the added pressure of growing backlog of remand cases. Ian Aitchison said locking up non-violent suspects for 5 years is an unacceptable use of state power. He warned that those on remand are often at far greater risk of self-harm because of their uncertain status. Conservative Justice Committee Chairman Sir Bob Neill warned that the churn of record numbers of remand inmates was putting further strain on prison officers. Sir Bob Neill said it can only increase the risk of violence when innocent people are locked up in prison without family visits or rehabilitation schemes, often in some of the worst conditions. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The worrying situation has led to a mental health crisis, with levels of suicide and self-harm among remand prisoners in the United Kingdom skyrocketing as people become hopeless. Griff Ferris, Fair Trials Senior Legal and Policy Officer, said remand inmates are often among those locked up in the cells for 23 hours a day in harrowing conditions, amounting to solitary confinement, forced to choose between calls to family and loved ones, exercise or showering, and denied access to education and other rehabilitative programs. Griff Ferris criticized the British government for actively contributing to the remand crisis by shredding infrastructure and legal aid, and said he believed Labour had avoided taking any meaningful action to challenge ministers over fears of being seen as soft on crime. Claiming that the government simply cannot get to grips with its basic duties, Shadow Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood insisted Labour would take immediate action to increase the number of Crown prosecutors at least half by half and build prison places pledged but not delivered by the Conservatives. Dieter Saliuka, whose brother, Liridan, 29 years old, died by suicide at His Majesty's prison at Belmarsh on 2nd of January 2020, weeks after his trial was pushed back 6 months, having already spent 5 months waiting, warned, "Our prisons are unsafe and unable to provide basic levels of care." Dieter Saliuka warned that those who see their remand custody limits extended, like her brother, wait and wait and lose hope. Speaking of those eventually acquitted, she added, "You're in prison for years and then you get found not guilty. What happens after that? You might lose your family, your job, your house, your employment, your relationships. You don't get any of that back and you don't get anything at all." Conversely, Law Society Deputy Vice President Richard Atkinson said, "There are certainly cases where defendants will have spent longer on remand than their potential sentence, with some opting to plead guilty to get out sooner, despite lawyers advising otherwise."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Reunion. Two of the five Iranians illegally detained by the U.S. have returned to the Islamic Republic, their homeland, reunited with their family. The crime? Conducting business, which the U.S. claimed had violated U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, the five prisoners held in Iranian jails have also been freed. Their crime, far more serious than just conducting business. They were charged with spying. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his team conducted very difficult behind-the-scenes talks, an arduous task since Iran and the U.S. cannot negotiate directly. Thanks to mediators in Qatar and in Oman, the release has taken place. This was deemed as a great accomplishment for the Raisi administration on humanitarian grounds. The Iranian President has promised that it would safeguard Iranians' rights and fight for Iran's rights at any cost. Incredible double standards are at play in the way Western media covered this story. It seems like the media forgot that the U.S. had imprisoned Iranians, illegally at that, in their prisons, emotionally covering the released prisoners from Iran, while condemning Iran and its officials. Not even scant coverage of the prisoners of the bereaved families on the Iranian side. One of the prisoners held by Iran on spying charges, Siamak Namazi, was a businessman held since 2015. He thanked the U.S. President Joe Biden for ultimately putting the lives of American citizens above politics, as if the Iranian president had not done that. But the politics Namazi is talking about is out of U.S.'s own doing. The sanctions-obsessed U.S. uses its sanctions policy to twist the arm of nations into following its foreign policy line. Even on the day of the prisoner release, U.S. sanctioned the former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was Iran's president 10 years ago. Additionally, the U.S. sanctioned Iran's intelligence ministry, and just days before that, it had sanctioned 29 individuals and entities in connection with what it claimed was violent suppression of nationwide protest, including Press TV. In the case of Siamak Namazi, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage and cooperation with the U.S. government and foreign intelligence networks. His company, Atiyeh Bahar Consulting in Tehran, was associated covertly, acting with the U.S. government's companies anti-Iranian in nature, like the VOA TV channel, the U.S. government's Institute for National Strategic Studies, INSS, at the Pentagon's National Defense University, and the Office of Iranian Affairs at the U.S. State Department. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in New York for the yearly UN General Assembly meeting. His spokesman said the message of Iranian President to the world is, quote, peace, justice, confronting discrimination and domination, unilateralism and terrorism, and the West supporting terrorist groups, the main messages of the Iranian nation. True to his word, since he came to power, the Iranian president has fast-tracked Iran's relations with a host of nations, extending his hand of friendship and peace to leaders from Latin America to Africa to West Asia and to the East with Asian countries. Yet the U.S. has described this government as what it calls a rogue terrorist regime. Question is, has Iran done anything to fit that description? Does Iran go and confiscate the earnings of another nation, forcing the country that has those funds to hold it hostage? Or does Iran go and confiscate another country's oil tanker at sea, which in essence is a form of piracy? In this case, the U.S. reason, it was a sanctions enforcement operation. These types of sanction-driven acts, however, have come back to haunt the U.S., along with its allies, like its European partners. Countries have realized that it is not Iran that has rogue elements, but the U.S. The sanctions regime, the weaponization of the dollar, and its foreign policy agenda has left the U.S. isolated on the international stage. Organizations like BRICS and the SCO are testament to that. Countries are rejecting the U.S. approach and are aligning themselves with each other. So when the U.S. and Western media are accusing Iran of executing a hostage and ransom act, this line doesn't have many buyers, especially when it comes to the topic of prisoners. A country that has the most number of prisoners inside its jails cannot accuse another country like Iran of being rogue, never mind the illegal torture that takes place there. The U.S. also has no credibility when it supports a regime like Israel, which detains and jails people without charge or trial, almost on a daily basis. This is while Iran inside the country has pardoned thousands of prisoners on a yearly basis based on Iran's leader discretion and approval. So the Western hostage and ransom narratives against Iran doesn't hold ground. Western pundits and so-called rights groups fail to mention Iranians languishing in U.S. prisons. They accuse Iran of falsifying charges against prisoners, like spying charges. Maybe the U.S. needs to be reminded how it was spying on Iran on a massive scale during the time it had an embassy in Iran. But the U.S. doesn't learn its lessons and continues down a path of failed maximum pressure campaign, a failure admitted by U.S. officials. This is why Iran will continue down its path of imprisoning anyone suspected of spying and acting against Iran's national security, as it has done countless number of times.
$10 an hour, 5 years, seniority.
One of the striking auto workers in the U.S. Thousands of United Auto Workers are officially on a strike after three Detroit automakers failed to reach an agreement with the union.
What appears that now is going to happen is the UAW is planning targeted strikes across all three companies. So striking at just specific plants.
We're going to get to that story soon. But did you know that the U.S. is experiencing strikes in other sectors as well? From UPS, the carrier service, to Starbucks, the coffee chain,
we pull the shots.
We call the shots.
Workers at many U.S. companies are taking to the streets. In short, they are fighting for better pay and improved working conditions.
We have hotel workers on strike across the region, everywhere from the L.A. Grand, which joined the strike this morning, J.W. Marriott, Ritz-Carlton.
We have a very weak labor law.
There are a lot of aspects of our economy and our politics that concentrate a lot of power in the hands of corporations.
And there may be more strikes to come. UPS employees started striking before reaching a deal. That would have involved some 340,000 workers. Close to 3,000 Starbucks workers protested what they called unfair labor practices. 1,400 members of the United Electrical Workers went on a strike after rejecting the company's contract offer. 6,000 workers at Boeing's Aerosystems went on a strike, also rejecting the company's contract offer. Add to that 80 Amazon drivers who protested unfair labor practices. And McDonald's employees in California went on a strike over paid sick leave. Well, it becomes evident how much of a common occurrence these strikes are. And we can't forget Hollywood. General Motors, Ford Motor Company, and Chrysler, well-known names in the car industry, brand names with record incomes, but not so for the average worker.
They should be paid more. The corporation is making billions of dollars. And these people have been with them and the cost of living and stuff like that. They've been with this company 20, 30 years.
Tens of thousands of the United Auto Workers are officially on a strike. The three Detroit automakers have failed to reach an agreement with the union, which represents about 146,000 workers. One major issue on the table, workers' pay. The union has proposed 40% hourly pay increases over the next 4 years. The average U.S. auto worker on a manufacturing production line earns about $28 per hour as of August. That's up only $1 from the previous year. The problem began on an agreement that the auto workers made with the government, which bailed out the big three automakers. The problem is, the workers hired in 2007 or earlier earned an average of $33 per hour, but the ones hired after 2007 earn only $17 an hour. Why? Because this agreement was made as a goodwill gesture to help the automakers get back on their feet after the crisis. But now auto workers' hourly earnings have fallen 19.3% since 2007. And that is not fair as they see it. Even the U.S. politicians see it that way, like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
The fight you are waging here is not just about decent wages and working conditions and pensions in the automobile industry. It is a fight to take on corporate greed and tell the people on top this country belongs to all of us, not just a few.
But strikes in the U.S. are happening at a more frequent pace compared to previous years. There were 424 work stoppages in 2022, including 417 strikes and 7 lockouts. Work stoppages increased by 52% from 2021 to 2022. The number of workers involved in work stoppages increased by 60% from 2021 to 2022. The number of striking workers as a consequence saw an increase. Since the year 2021, the numbers have been rising steadily, with 650,000 to have threatened to go on a strike so far this year. The strikes point to a deeper problem within the U.S. economy. Things are not that rosy when it comes to Americans' income and economic well-being. For example, homelessness has been on the rise in several states, most notably California, and also in New York City.
The unhoused population has exploded with the addition of the new arrivals. For example, here at St. Bartholomew's Church, where we start serving, we're seeing on average anywhere from 250 to 275 people, more or less regularly. Once the new arrivals started coming, our numbers got up over 400 people.
Migration agency IOM has raised the alarm over the high number of migrants killed while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. It has described the U.S.-Mexico border as the world's deadliest land route for migrants. At least 686 deaths and disappearances were reported in the border crossing last year, The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded through the Americas in 2022, the deadliest year on record since IOM's Missing Migrants Project began in 2014. The data underscores the growing death toll and increasing risks that migrants face throughout the region. These figures represent the lowest estimates available, as many more deaths are likely to go unrecorded due to a lack of data from official sources. Nearly half of the deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border were linked to the hazardous crossing of the Sonoran and the Chihuahuan deserts, far more than other desert regions where irregular migration is prevalent.
The International Organization for Migration documented the deaths and disappearances of 686 migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas last year, the deadliest on record since the Missing Migrants Project began in 2014.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers have taken long and perilous paths through South and Central America and Mexico in hopes of reaching the U.S. border to apply for protection. Many are fleeing rampant gang violence, poverty, political persecution, and other crises in their home countries. This is while the U.S. is accused of ignoring the plight of migrants. From an economic perspective, it is the U.S. that benefits from the contribution of migrants to the nation's GDP. Many of those immigrants that come to the U.S. through its southern borders end up working in farms and construction sites owned by big companies. It's been argued that increased immigration promotes U.S. economic growth and helps tackle labor shortages and inflation. U.S. President Joe Biden, who is under pressure from Republicans, has launched new restrictions and programs to discourage people from trying to apply for asylum at the frontier. The measures have been put in place amid record numbers of arrivals at the border since he took office in early 2021. The measures introduced by the Biden administration include a rule that disqualifies people from seeking asylum in the U.S. if they did not first apply in countries that they crossed earlier in their journeys. Rights groups have slammed the measure as an asylum ban. The Biden administration has also opened so-called safe mobility centers in Latin America to allow asylum seekers to apply for U.S. protection in third countries instead of at the border with Mexico. But migrants and asylum seekers continue to head to the border. For years, Central American nations have stepped up immigration enforcement efforts, often at the behest of the United States, erecting new obstacles for the steady stream of people making the journey north. The journey is plagued with violence, with areas under the control of criminal networks and armed groups.
The Darien Gap, an inhospitable jungle border crossing between Panama and Colombia, saw 141 documented migrant deaths in 2022. The remote and dangerous nature of this area and the presence of criminal gangs along the route means that this figure likely does not represent the actual number of lives lost.
The surge in arrivals has piled political pressure on the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, whose Republican rivals have accused him of causing chaos at the border. In 2021, U.S. authorities reportedly detained 1.7 million migrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border.
Let me be clear. The lifting of the Title 42 public health order does not mean our border is open. In fact, it is the contrary. Our use of our immigration enforcement authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code means tougher consequences for people who cross the border illegally.
Marking an all-time high and highlighting the deepening political and humanitarian challenges the Biden administration is facing on immigration, the U.S. has been increasingly reliant on Mexico to stem the flow of migrants. As it returns to Mexico, the majority of people who arrive at the border under a Trump-era border restriction enacted due to the coronavirus pandemic.
President Ebrahim Raisi has underscored Iran's full authority on its recently released assets. Raisi said it is the Islamic Republic that decides how to spend the funds and that the money will be spent, quote, wherever we need it.
This money belongs to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and naturally, we will decide, the Islamic Republic of Iran will decide to spend it wherever we need it.
So if I hear you clearly, that it will be used for more than humanitarian purposes, in your view?
Humanitarian means whatever the Iranian people needs. So this money will be budgeted for those needs. And the needs of the Iranian people will be decided and determined by the Iranian government.
Raisi made the remarks in an exclusive interview with the American broadcast television network NBC in the capital, Tehran. He pointed to the last month's deal between Iran and the United States to exchange prisoners and to secure the release of $6 billion of Iranian funds that had remained blocked in two South Korean banks since 2018 because of U.S. pressure on Seoul. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden claimed at the time that the funds and the proceeds of Iranian oil sales to South Korea could only be spent on humanitarian purposes.
The system is set up such that this money, these funds, can only be parceled out for humanitarian purposes.
The Biden administration has announced that it had taken concrete steps to clear the way for the prisoner exchange and also issuing a waiver that allows international banks to transfer the $6 billion to Qatar without the threat of U.S. sanctions. The waiver means that European, Middle Eastern and Asian banks will not be in violation of U.S. sanctions in converting Iran's money, which was frozen in South Korea, and transferring it to Qatar's central bank, where it will be held for Tehran. Top Iranian officials have emphasized that there is no connection between the prisoner exchange agreement reached with the United States and the release of Iran's frozen assets. U.S. sanctions have mostly targeted Iran's sale of crude oil and its ability to engage in dollar transactions in the global banking system. The Iranian funds were illegally blocked under the pretext of U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations has confirmed that five Iranians detained illegally in the United States on charges of circumventing U.S. sanctions will soon be released as part of a prisoner swap deal between Tehran and Washington. The five Iranian detainees were identified as Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi, Mehrdad Muin Ansari, Amin Hassanzadeh, Reza Sarhangpour Kofrani, and Kambiz Attar Kashani. The prisoner exchange agreement was officially announced on August 10th, following 2 years of indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington. In a gesture of goodwill, Iran has moved four American detainees from prison to house arrest. They joined the fifth American who was already under house arrest in Tehran. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has expressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to negotiate last year's draft agreement aimed at salvaging the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the JCPOA, and removing illegal U.S. sanctions. Amir Abdollahian underscored the current administration's efforts to neutralize Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic while keeping the window open for negotiations to remove the illegal U.S. bans. The United States, under former President Donald Trump, abandoned the JCPOA in May 2018 and reinstated sanctions that the agreement had lifted. The talks to revive the 2015 deal kicked off in the Austrian capital city of Vienna in April 2021 with the intention of removing anti-Iran sanctions and examining the U.S. seriousness in rejoining the JCPOA. The discussions, however, have been at a standstill since August 2022 due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were slapped on Tehran by the previous U.S. administration.
What the Americans want to do is have a JCPOA where they don't abide by their commitments in full, and the Iranians do so. And the Iranians are not going to have that again. When Obama signed the deal, he systematically violated the deal from day one. And then Trump tore up the deal. And Biden, despite criticizing Trump, he pursued Trump's maximum pressure policy, which was directed at ordinary Iranians.
Iran has consistently said that it has not left the negotiations with the Western side and that it was the United States which has blocked the talks with its excessive demands.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow.
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
With the UK military seeing 30% decline in regular forces recruits, the country has resorted to review its recruitment policies to allow it to access a wider pool of people, including those suffering from certain neurological conditions like autism. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Financial Times, the British military could review its recruitment policies to allow it to access a wider pool of people, including those suffering from certain neurological conditions. Morrison, who serves as Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for Defence People, Veterans and Service Families, argued that this would help provide the armed forces with the skilled professionals amid chronic staffing shortages. In an interview with Financial Times published recently, Morrison explained that there are pinch points where things are quite serious, adding that the UK military should adopt a more flexible approach toward hiring new personnel. The MP stated that with the armed forces placing increasing emphasis on cyber warfare, it should start casting the net more widely to hire neurodiverse people. According to Morrison, while personnel with dyslexia and dyspraxia are already serving in the British military, the door should now be open to candidates with autism, Asperger's, and ADHD. These people may possess skills and attributes which others don't, the lawmaker argued. Morrison also suggested allowing older personnel to continue serving for longer, as there is no philosophical barrier as to why we couldn't look at extending the age of retirement. In June, a government-commissioned analysis revealed that the British military was failing to attract technologically skilled recruits. The NATO Deputy Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, General Tim Radford, also warned last month that London could cease to be a major power within the US-led bloc, as its military is too small. Speaking to the Daily Telegraph, the commander stressed that the modern technology which Britain is betting on cannot fully replace traditional armed forces. Last month, a survey of British military personnel conducted between September 2022 and February 2023 indicated that only 42% of troops were satisfied with service life. Among the main grievances highlighted by the poll were poor housing conditions and low wages. Commenting on the state of affairs in the British military, Defence Secretary Ben Wallace acknowledged back in January that it was hollowed out and underfunded. According to the website of Army Technology, newly released figures show near total reductions across the board for the UK military as recruitment and retention rates fall amid a worsening economic decline. The strength of the UK armed forces dropped by 3.3% between October 1, 2021 and October 2022, according to the latest recruitment and retention figures released by the UK government, with just 5,090 people joining the regular forces, a 29.8% decrease registered during the reported period. Releasing the quarterly service personnel statistics on December 15th, the UK government revealed that the total strength of UK forces personnel stood at 192,300 as of October 1, 2022. This marked a 6,640 decrease in service personnel compared to the same point last year. Further decreases were registered in the full-time trained strength of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and Royal Air Force, RAF, and the full-time trained strength of the British Army on October 1, 2022, with the figure standing at 134,940, a decrease of 2,190 or 1.6% from October 1, 2021. Recruitment has also registered a steep drop, with 11,982 people joining the UK regular forces in the past 12 months, that is, between October 1, 2021 to September 30, 2022, a decrease of 5,090, that is 29.8%, compared with the previous 12-month period. Tellingly, retention is also suffering, with 16,250 people leaving the UK regular forces between October 1, 2021 and September 30, 2022, or more than 1,300 per month, an increase of 2,400, that is 17.4% compared with the previous 12-month period. Further decreases were registered when comparing the full-time trained strength of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and RAF, and the full-time trained strength of the British Army at October 1, 2022 of 134,940, a decrease of 2,190, 1.6% from October 1, 2022. Recruitment has also registered a steep drop, with 11,982 people joining the UK regular forces in the past 12 months, a decrease of 5,090 compared with the previous 12-month period.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution on Wednesday, September 6, 2003. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, may your prayers be accepted, may your invocations be accepted. God willing, may your weeping, attentiveness, and supplications receive divine favor and be answered by God. How fortunate you young people are! Enlightened hearts are polished mirrors that are ready to attract God's favors. This is a true description of you, young people. First of all, I apologize that there was not enough space at the time of the prayer and you were inconvenienced. Each of these gatherings for taking recourse and your state of invocation is a connection and communication with the eternal spiritual light of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In these invocations, we connect the extinguished candle of our hearts to the all-pervading shining light of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. You enlighten your hearts. The name of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the way of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, turning our attention to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and the invocation of Hussein ibn Ali, the master of the martyrs, opens the way. Hussein is the true sense of the world. Hussein is the light of guidance. You can sense this guidance in your mind and within yourselves. Anyone who attends a gathering for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam will undoubtedly benefit spiritually from it. There is no doubt about it.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Whenever one of us attends one of these religious gatherings for an hour, our hearts become cleaner and brighter in comparison with the way they were at the beginning of that hour. What is important for us is to keep this. It is important to keep the brightness. In the beautiful poem that you sang at the beginning of this meeting, you said that this path is the path of determination. Yes, it is the path of determination. You need to move with determination. You must make decisions as you are moving. There are many attractions to distance you from this straight path. These diversions from the straight path have always existed, and this is true even more today than ever before. You need to have a strong determination in order to be able to resist these evil attractions. If you resist them, you will be able to reach the peak.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
As the Zionist regime heads in its terrifying direction, the British government promotes legislation that sends out the message that the Zionist regime can pursue its illegal settlements program with all the horrifying settler violence that goes with it, with total impunity. The anti-BDS bill trashes the UK's global reputation, yet Sunak's morally broken government is pushing it through without serious scrutiny. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, this week British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly will receive a welcome from the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the occupied territories on a mission to build trade links. But the truth is that the British government has already given Netanyahu everything he could possibly want, and more. Consider the 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel bilateral relations, which ignored the occupation and defined the Zionist regime as a thriving democracy, signed by Cleverly before Netanyahu's visit to London last March. And now we have the abominably named Economic Activity of Public Bodies, Overseas Matters Bill, which entered its committee stage in the Commons last week. It delivers on a central objective of Netanyahu's foreign policy, protecting the Zionist regime against the threat of international isolation by blocking public bodies from supporting sanctions, boycotts, and divestment campaigns against the fabricated regime of Israel. Most unusually, the bill singles out the Zionist regime, the occupied West Bank, and the Golan Heights for special protection. It thus puts not just the Zionist regime, but also the occupied Palestinian territories and the occupied Golan Heights out of reach of the boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS movement. And not just that, by conflating the Zionist regime with the territories it has occupied by military force, the bill flatly contradicts existing British foreign policy commitments. Britain is a signatory to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334. This resolution, a formal commitment entered into by UNSC member states, calls upon all states to distinguish in their relevant dealings between the territory of the regime of Israel and the territories occupied since 1967. The protection granted to the Zionist regime settlements in the new legislation makes a nonsense of Britain's solemn UN commitments. The bill is being driven through the Commons as Rishi Sunak's morally and politically broken government enters its final month in office. Incredibly, Sunak has pressed ahead in the face of warnings from his own Foreign Office officials that the bill not only contradicts British foreign policy, but actually represents a propaganda gift for other people. As British reported, Foreign Office lawyers advised that a clause in the bill would significantly increase the risk of the UK being in breach of the commitments under UNSC Resolution 2334. In spite of this powerful and highly unusual warning, Sunak ignored this advice and pressed ahead with the bill. And his government is cynically using every trick in the book to push it through Parliament. There are deep problems with the government's management of the committee stage of the bill. As Arib Ollah reported for Middle East Eye recently, not a single Palestinian has been invited to give evidence to Parliament. Not one, yet a raft of pro-Israeli voices were heard. The Times journalist Melanie Phillips was invited. In her powerful columns, she denies the existence of Islamophobia and is critical even of Jewish critics of the Zionist regime. Phillips has written that there are no good reasons to oppose the bill. In the committee, her views were heard with deep, indeed, sycophantic respect. George Howard, a Labour MP and the chair of the committee, thanked Phillips for her characteristically forthright responses, which have been very helpful. What a telling indication of where Keir Starmer's Labour now stands on Palestine. But no pro-Palestine columnist was brought into balance Phillips. Why not? Here's another example of unfairness. Conservative friends of the Zionist regime gave evidence, but no balancing invitation for Conservative Friends of Palestine, chaired by former cabinet minister Saida Warsi. Again, why not? UK lawyers for the Zionist regime gave evidence, but no balancing invitation for lawyers for Palestinian human rights. Once again, why not? The Jewish Leadership Council gave evidence, but not the British Palestinian Committee, and so on. This fundamental bias became obvious at the very start of the committee stage recently. Committee members were required to make a declaration of interest as demanded by Commons rules. The revelations were astonishing. 7 of the 10 Conservative MPs on the 19-member committee said they had visited the occupied territories on trips organized by Conservative Friends of Israel. 6 of them revealed that they were personal friends of James Gard, executive director of Conservative Friends of Israel and one of the witnesses. 3 of the 7 Labour members of the committee said they had been on trips to the occupied territories organized by Labour Friends of Israel, among them George Howard, the chair of the committee. Just one MP, Labour's Kim Leadbeater, said she had been on a trip organized by the Council for Arab-British Understanding, which stands up for Palestinian human rights. Ever since Netanyahu re-emerged as prime minister of the fabricated regime of Israel last December, events inside the occupied territories, and especially the occupied West Bank, have taken a turn for the worse. Netanyahu has elevated Itamar Ben-Gvir from the status of the Palestinian-hating far-right Kahanist politician to the position of Minister of National Security. By giving Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich control of the illegal West Bank settlements, Netanyahu has broken precedent and accelerated the annexation of the West Bank land. Settler violence has escalated in a terrifying way, and the vast expansion of settlement building is part of a systematic program to make a Palestinian state impossible. Meanwhile, Netanyahu himself has embarked on a program of judicial reform that threatens to dismantle democracy within the occupied territories itself. Yet, as the regime of Israel heads in this terrifying direction, the Sunni government promotes legislation that sends out the message that the Zionist regime can pursue its illegal settlements program with all the horrifying settler violence that goes with it, with total impunity. In the meantime, Wafa News Agency reported Zionist settlers recently attempt to seize a large area of Palestinian-owned lands in the area of Masafer Yatta, south of the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, under the protection of the Zionist regime occupation forces, Anti-settlement activist Rateb Jabour said that dozens of settlers placed barbed wire around approximately 50 dunams belonging to Al-Hatalin and Zain families adjacent to the illegal Zionist settlement of Karmail in an attempt to seize it with the aim of expanding the settlement. The occupation forces had issued a plan to expand the said settlements at the expense of Palestinian lands located between Om al-Khair and Sadat al-Tala areas, specifically on the eastern side of the aforementioned settlement, while Masafer Yatta is subjected to a continuous attack by Zionist settlers to seize thousands of dunams from Palestinian citizens' lands.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians keep descending further into poverty and de-development under the Israeli occupation. In a report released on Monday, the World Bank said poverty rates are stubbornly high, as roughly one out of four Palestinians live below the poverty line. Palestinian non-governmental organizations say the poverty is more severe in Gaza.
In Gaza, the situation is more and more catastrophic comparing to the West Bank due to the blockade imposed for the 16 years. We have high deterioration on the humanitarian conditions, also on the economic standards. Due to this blockade, we have food insecurity.
They say that the Israeli occupation and blockade are the main culprits behind the increase in poverty among Palestinians. The Abu Ajwa family in Gaza's Zeitoun neighborhood, where more than a dozen people reside. Their average daily income is only around $5 a day. The abject poverty has forced them to live in miserable conditions.
Look at my house. It is falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. You can't even imagine how hard it is for me or for my family. Our living conditions and those of many families here are disastrous. We can hardly afford to put food on the table. Poverty has taken its toll on us, and I don't see any improvement to our situation anytime soon.
The situation of the Abu Ajwa family is just a small example of how thousands of people live in the tiny territory. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive as their incomes continue to dwindle. More than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been living under intensified access restrictions since 2007 and are largely isolated from the outside world.
The people who are in need for humanitarian assistance, 80% of the population, and most of them children, women, elders, who are in bad need for such assistance on time, we are suffering from shortage of funding for humanitarian aid. This will lead for more deterioration in the humanitarian and socio-economic situation.
Daily life is a constant struggle for most Gazans because of the inhumane Israeli practices.
According to experts, the Israeli regime is responsible for the high poverty rate and the near collapse of Palestine's economy, as well as its isolation from the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
According to the EU's own official data, 74% of small and medium-sized businesses within the 27-country bloc cannot find skilled workers. At the same time, millions of young people are unemployed. EU Youth Affairs Ministers met on Monday and Tuesday to discuss the crisis.
I think it's very obvious that we have a generation of young people who have been living through crisis after crisis since 2008. The financial crisis, the COVID pandemic, and now they're going through the consequences of a war at the heart of Europe.
The neglect of young adults in the EU was acknowledged last week in the European Parliament.
8 million young people are neither in employment, nor in education, nor in training. 8 million. Their dreams put on hold, their lives on standby.
Youth ministers have agreed to coordinate efforts across the EU to